The house manager was awkward. Miss Huntington was not in attendance. Paul asked when she might arrive. She won't. Miss Huntington had given the Metropolitan Board just a few days' notice, he explained. She'd said that the city no longer suited her. She'd left no sign of where she might be headed. This information was repeated by every one of whom he inquired over the following days. No one had seen Agnes. Her house was being put up for sale. Even Stanford White told Paul by way of letter that he'd heard the news of Agnes's sudden departure but hadn't any idea where she'd replanted her flag. Though if Paul did find her, would he please bring her back? 3 sleepless nights later, Paul read in the society pages a most curious item. The Chanteuse Agnes Huntington's engagement to Henry LeBar Jane had been called off. "Did he jilt Paul Jones?" read the titillating headline in the Washington Post, referring to Agnes by her most famous role. Paul's further inquiries confirmed that the Jane clan had departed en masse for Philadelphia. This was a blow for their beloved son, but it was survivable. It seemed that Agnes had simultaneously turned her back on both the city of her dreams and the safe perch of a marriage into wealth and stature. What she had once craved, she had apparently renounced. And now she was somewhere else, searching for something else. It didn't take Paul long to figure out where she'd gone. The Chicago Railway didn't even stop in Kalamazoo. But the Michigan Central did, after a transfer in Toledo. Kalamazoo wasn't a place someone went to be noticed. It was a place someone went to escape. Paul arrived on a bright winter day. His hired carriage took him to a 2-story wooden house at the center of the snowy town. It hadn't been hard to find the address. Property was not bought and sold too frequently, so just a few conversations with locals gave him the information he needed. Fanny was at the door when he arrived at the brown slatted house. She clearly wasn't happy to see Paul ascending the steps of her new home, but she allowed him a cup of tea and the few minutes he required to deliver some news. As for the request that accompanied his explanation, she admitted it wasn't hers to grant. When Agnes came downstairs, she gave little reaction at the sight of Paul. "What stubborn need for abuse brought you here?"
"Now, now," interrupted Fanny. "He's not quite as foolish as I used to think."
And with that, Fanny took her leave. Agnes leaned against the kitchen cabinets, wrapping her orange cotton dress tightly around herself.
"This is the most chipper I've seen my mother since we left New York.
I read about you and Henry Jane."
"Did you travel here to file a report for the society page?"
"Miss Huntington," said Paul, "I've spent most of the time since I met you making a lot of pretty terrible decisions, and I'd like to make a good one for a change. So here it is. I've come here to tell you that I'm in love with you."
She didn't even blink.
"I'm sorry for taking advantage of Tesla. I betrayed his trust."
"Then I don't think that I'm the one who needs your apology."
"But I'm going to make it up to you. Listen, these giants in whose shadows we've played our games, they're terrible. Those great men and their great obsessions, I want no more of them. What I want is you."
Agnes scoffed.
"I thought that winning was enough," said Paul. "It wasn't. I thought that success... well, I thought that success would mean something. It doesn't. Because success is in the eye of the beholder. And the only eyes I care to be witnessed by belong to you."
"You were always good at speeches."
Paul took in the humble kitchen.
You've gone into hiding.
I've gone into reality.
He couldn't do it in the end. The pretend name, the pretend life, the pretend you for the whole rest of your years. You thought you could, but it wasn't worth it.
She looked to the floor.
It was hard to tell if she was more upset with Paul in that moment or herself.
Nicola described something to me once. Refraction, he called it. The way light is broken up into component colors when it passes through a prism. I felt like a refraction of a person. So many different shades that layer to create the illusion of a solid thing. I was only what was reflected back in others. A demure princess from my mother, a full-throated mimic on the stage, a smiling wit for my fiancé. All parts to be played. I thought it was worth it until I saw. Until you saw what it did to me. She looked up at him. If I stayed, I would have been no better than you.
The remark stung.
So you came back here. You'll sing at a local theater somewhere. If anyone recognizes Agnes Googe, no one will care. If anyone recognizes Agnes Huntington, no one will believe it. Her plan was sound. But Paul had done everything he could to see that it might be rendered unnecessary.
What if you can keep New York without pretending?
With you as my new Jane? She asked incredulously. I read that you won your war, but that doesn't give you as much power as you think.
It doesn't give me much at all. But I'm not the one who's going to give you New York.
Her brow furrowed.
Thomas Edison is. For the first time since he'd arrived, he had surprised her. What I have here is a letter, he said, removing it from his coat pocket. It's from a Sergeant Crows of the Boston Police. Her expression made clear that she could not possibly guess where this was going. In it, continued Paul, the good sergeant informs my friend Charles Batchelor that there are no records of a theft occurring at the Endicott House in 1881. That the police do not have, nor have they ever had, such a record, and that he spoke to the Endicott family who have assured him that no such theft ever occurred. Paul watched as she struggled to process what he was telling her. So massive were the implications of his words that she could not immediately wrap her mind around them.
But that's impossible, she said.
Paul smiled. Your mother is safe. So are you.
How did you...
It is my understanding that Charles Batchelor, trusted employee of Thomas Edison and J.P. Morgan, made very clear to the Endicott family and to the Boston police that his employers had taken an interest in the crime, and that it would be in everyone's interest, for reasons left unspoken, if the incident had never occurred.
The family agreed to forget about it because Charles Batchelor told them to?
The names Edison and Morgan are quite powerful ones, even in Boston. She appeared as if a decade of tension was being released from her body. Paul could almost see her shoulders start to relax.
You're free now, he said.
You can be Agnes Googe. You can be Agnes Huntington. Or you can even go become Agnes Jane if you want. But you don't need his name to protect you. You have your own, and your mother has hers.
Agnes said nothing.
She held herself still against the cabinets. What was required of me to do all this was an act of dishonesty. But look at what it has allowed. The lives of everyone involved are better off for it. I sinned in the service of a better America. If you return with me to New York, we can spend the rest of our lives making up for it. Not everyone involved is better off, Paul.
Tesla is not so hard up as you might think. Not only does he have a new laboratory, but he has a new company as well.
How can he afford to found a new company?
Because, believe it or not, he has acquired his first investor, and the man has awfully deep pockets. J.P. Morgan, I'm negotiating the deal myself. She gave a start. It couldn't be denied that whatever else he was, Paul was a very good lawyer.
We can do anything now, he said.
We can be anyone. We can give a fortune to charity. We can found civic institutions to outlast us both. We can make New York a place where the next boy from Nashville and the next girl from Kalamazoo are welcomed with open arms. We can look after Tesla and make sure that he's always cared for. We can do all of this and so much more. But if I cannot do this at your side, then there's no point. If you would consider returning to New York, he continued, I have a humble request. Don't marry Henry Jane. Marry me instead. He took a step closer. Do you know that in our adventures we came to know three men who in their own ways each changed the world? And do you know what I can't stop thinking about? Why did they do it? What made them fight, strive, connive so hard for so long? She raised an eyebrow.
That's what you want to talk about right now? Just hear me out, pleaded Paul. What did they love?
The three of them. Edison loved the audience. For him, it was the performance, it was the crowd. He remains the most famous inventor in the world. I'll bet he stays that way for generations. He wanted the applause. That's what he was fighting for. Now Westinghouse was different. He loved the products themselves, and he made them better than anyone. He is the ultimate craftsman, isn't he? He didn't want to sell the most light bulbs. He wanted to make the best light bulbs. If they were too expensive, if they were too late into production, he didn't care. They had to be the best, the most useful, the most current technology. And he did, didn't he? It's his products that won out. He wanted to perfect the light bulb, and he did it. Then there's Tesla. He was the third leg in this tripod. He didn't care a bit about Edison's public or Westinghouse's products. No, Tesla cared only for the ideas themselves. Their promulgation did not matter. Tesla was his own audience, and his ideas were his product, for consumption by himself alone. He had the idea, then he was done. Once he knew he'd solved the problem, he moved on. He knew that he'd made AC work. He knew that he'd made the bulbs work. Actually, building the things was irrelevant. That was someone else's problem. And look, they all got what they wanted, because they wanted such different things. I've been trying so hard all this time to understand them. And what I understand now is that I never will, because I'm not like them.
You wanted to win, said Agnes.
Yes, and I did. It was the same as losing. Edison gets the audience. Westinghouse gets the excellence. Tesla gets the ideas. But all I really want is you. She smiled. In the years to come, Paul would see many of these smiles. He would come to know well their shapes, their shadings, their infinite variety of splendors. And yet, of all the million smiles that she would show him, it would be this particular one, grinned on that particular afternoon, that would forever be his favorite.
You're getting better at the speeches, she said.
Chapter 71. post-war. The game of science is, in principle, without end. He who decides one day that scientific statements do not call for any further test, and that they can be regarded as finally verified, retires from the game. Karl Popper. Paul married Agnes Huntington in a ceremony at St. Thomas Church. They moved to an apartment on 58th Street, one block from Central Park. Agnes soon stopped singing professionally, but never stopped singing at home. Sometimes Paul imagined that her voice had seeped so deeply into the apartment's bright wood that the walls would reverberate ever on with the sound of her arias. Their daughter, Vera, was born in 1895. She looked the spitting image of her mother. Fanny Huntington lived close by. Together, Paul and Agnes participated in the founding of the Council on Foreign Relations, and Paul became one of its officers. Paul served as corporate counsel for the Metropolitan Opera and then the chairman of its board. In time, he would be a director of the Philharmonic, a trustee of the Juilliard School of Music, the chairman of the board of Fisk University, the president of the Italy-America Society, and an official of the India Society of America. Paul and Agnes became among the greatest of Manhattan's philanthropists. And yet, the name of Nikola Tesla would always haunt their marriage. Paul's sins against the man would be recalled whenever they struggled both to do well and to do good, and whenever they fought behind closed doors. In the years that followed, the Westinghouse Electric Company's system became the national standard for generating and harnessing electrical power. By way of its licensing arrangement with the newly christened General Electric, Westinghouse provided the power to light the country from coast to coast using alternating current. At the same time, GE itself switched standards and sold many times more bulbs. Under Charles Coffin, its profitability tripled. Both companies grew to be among the largest in the world. Paul remained the lead counsel for the Westinghouse Electric Company for a while, until he was able to transition the company into hiring an in-house counsel. Paul chose the young man himself and remained on retainer as a consultant. It was time for him to move on. Paul and Westinghouse remained cordial business associates, if not close ones. Paul never asked him about the fire. There was nothing Paul could do about it, and nothing, even if Westinghouse did admit it, that he could prove. No one would benefit from an argument. Their relationship cooled, but never froze. Westinghouse was not the father that Paul wanted. He had his own. Erastus Cravath even visited New York every now and again to see his granddaughter. To be sure, those years saw their share of intrigue. J.P. Morgan attempted a hostile takeover of Westinghouse, failed, and then tried it again. The effective monopoly created by the licensing partnership didn't suit his balance sheets quite so well as would a literal one. But Westinghouse, with Paul at his side, saw these attacks coming. Morgan was kept at bay, and the Westinghouse Electric Company remained free of outside ownership. Paul became known for his cunning, not merely on the lawyerly blocks of Broadway, but on Wall Street as well. Paul founded a new firm with his associates. His success as Westinghouse's chief counsel served as no small advertisement to future clients. He soon had dozens. Most were household names. Paul eventually took over William Seward's old firm, originally founded decades before its name partner had successfully negotiated the Alaska Purchase. Paul soon brought on Hoyt Moore, an expert in the new field of taxation law, which was becoming more important to the firm's larger corporate clients. Eventually, Paul would promote his own protege to a partnership. Bob Swain, a bright young man only a few years out from Harvard Law. No one's perfect. Moreover, the pyramidal structure he had developed to handle the light bulb suit proved useful on other cases as well. He wrote of his Cravath system in various journals.
Its method was that each suit was overseen by a partner at the firm, below which a team of associates handled the daily drudgery of legal work. The associates ascended through a hierarchy of their own, based on the length of time they'd been with the firm. First years, second years, and so forth. On and on up the totem pole until one day, if they were quite lucky, they might become partners themselves. The system rivaled Westinghouse's factories for efficiency of production. Paul had turned the practice of law from a craft into an industry. As attorneys from Washington to San Francisco had learned of his system, they'd begun adopting his methods. If only, he thought, one were able to patent the practice of law as one might patent the devices the law protected. Even Nikola Tesla prospered on and off. While Tesla saw not a cent of income from his work on alternating current, the enterprise he founded with J.P. Morgan's money did not go bankrupt until 1903. His personal wealth, while nothing compared to Edison's or Westinghouse's, was enough for him to take a room at the Waldorf Astoria. It was a short walk from there to Delmonico's, where Tesla would dine every single night without fail. The manager gave him his own table, which they set each evening especially for him. The writer, Robert Underwood Johnson, and his wife Catherine made it their sworn mission to find Tesla a suitable mate. Though the couple introduced him to all the most eligible women in New York, and some even took a fancy to the tall, commanding genius, he never reciprocated their affections. Paul saw him around the city a few times, at dinner and a number of parties. Agnes made sure to attend every event at which she knew he'd be present. She kept close watch over him at first, but over time they grew distant. The fame that she had given up openly delighted him. For a time, his name was spread almost as wide as Edison's. Journalists lined up to profile him. He became one of the city's great characters, a mysterious and eccentric sage, a ganglier oracle at Delphi. Paul and Agnes watched as Tesla enjoyed the show. His black suits, Agnes pointed out, were always immaculate. Ever alone in his own world, Tesla had learned to pause and occasionally savor the delicacies of this one. Paul would never know it, but Nikola Tesla would outlive them all. He died quite penniless in 1943, having had to trade the Waldorf Astoria for a single occupancy hotel. Tesla never did invent the non-infringing light bulb that Paul had once so desperately needed. Westinghouse's engineering team did. Under Westinghouse's leadership, they worked methodically to modify the old Sawyer and Mann patent. Instead of a single piece of glass surrounding the filament, they used two. Called the double stopper lamp, it was mass-produced in Westinghouse's own airbrake factory just in time to light the World's Columbian Exposition of 1893. The courts instantly and unequivocally ruled that this light bulb was fundamentally different from Edison's. Arguably, the most lucrative invention of the entire current war did not arrive in any grand spark of individual genius, but rather flowed from a simple, painstakingly achieved modification to a decade-old British design performed over 3 years by a team of organized experts. Westinghouse held the patent on the double-stopper lamp, but no one person could quite claim to have invented it. And then, of course, there was perhaps the greatest irony of the age, the curious and unexpected fate of U.S. Letters Patent number 223,898. Paul and his associates pursued the case vigorously. So did Morgan and Coffin, who could use the victory to bludgeon a number of smaller electrical companies into either bankruptcy or more profitable licensing arrangements. Westinghouse, flush from success, was happy to spend the legal fees in order to defend his good name. For Paul, it was all a matter of pride. This was the largest patent infringement case in the world.
The attorney who litigated it successfully would secure a place in history. And so it was that Paul found himself arguing before the Supreme Court of the United States. He argued brilliantly, defending himself against Justice Fuller's quick barbs. He did his work well, and it was a sight to behold. It was the capstone to any lawyer's career. A few weeks later, Paul found out the result. He lost. And no one much cared. Edison v. Westinghouse had become an undead lawsuit. It had lived on far past the point that either of its named litigants cared about its result. By the time Edison's patent was upheld in court, it was soon to expire. Westinghouse's double-stopper lamps were already on the market, so he was forbidden from manufacturing a bulb that he'd already stopped making. The few minor electrical companies that had continued using designs similar to Edison's, in the hopes of a Westinghouse victory, were duly sent out of business. In some quiet, smoky room somewhere, Morgan crossed another victory off a long list. It was, Paul realized, the fate of lawyers that they might lose the case, but win the war. In the rest of Paul Cravath's life, he would see Thomas Edison on only one more occasion. Chapter 72. Niagara Falls, 1896. My model for business is the Beatles. They were four guys who kept each other's negative tendencies in check. They balanced each other, and the total was greater than the sum of the parts. That's how I see business. Great things in business are never done by one person. They're done by a team of people. Steve Jobs. On the day that he would last see Thomas Edison, Paul watched 100 million gallons of white water pour over the great lip of Niagara Falls. A 29-ton turbine used the raw force of those tumbling gallons to spin a generator that converted it into enough alternating current to power tens of thousands of household light bulbs. Paul was there for a gala reception to mark the opening of the largest electrical power generator in the world. It had been built by Westinghouse, designed based on Tesla's ideas, and would power lamps across the East Coast that had been manufactured by Edison's former company, GE. The unveiling was a ceremony of a size as unprecedented as the plant itself. Every figure of any prominence in the American electrical community was in attendance. Which meant, so Paul realized as he stood at the falls, that Thomas Edison, George Westinghouse, and Nikola Tesla would for one evening all be in the same place. To Paul's amazement, this had never happened before. He knew that it would almost certainly never happen again. It was after the dull, formal ceremony that Paul stood in the open air, sipping from a flute of champagne as he watched the churning waters. It was nice to be reminded that of all the fantastic things he'd seen in his life, of all the man-made inventions he'd witnessed, none held the power that Niagara did. Or rather, that even Westinghouse's perfect current depended upon nature for its power. The God of Paul's father still powered the devices of Paul's client. From the corner of his eye, Paul saw Edison leaning against the railing over the water. To Paul's surprise, Westinghouse was with him, as was Tesla. They were talking. Paul didn't know whether to approach the group, but Edison caught a glimpse of him and waved him over. "Mr. Cravath," said Edison, "I didn't know if you'd be here." Paul nodded. What was there to say to this man whose life had once so dominated his own? "Mr. Bell sends his greetings," said Edison. "Excuse me?" "Mr. Bell says hello."
I was at dinner with him in Nova Scotia just the other month. He told me the story of your visit.
Paul was startled. He said he was helping me for your sake.
Edison nodded. It worked. I'll have to have you down to my new laboratory sometime. I've been working on motion pictures.
Paul's face made clear he had no clue as to what the phrase motion pictures might refer.
You should see Mr. Paul Cravath, added Tesla. Many photographs all in a row. It creates an appearance of a real thing moving.
How have you seen it? Asked Paul.
My laboratory on Fifth Avenue, New York, has gotten crowded. I broke some items.
Tesla shook his head sadly.
I am clumsy. It is possible with my things. Mr. Thomas Edison offered a space for working to myself, while some unnecessaries were cleaned away.
It's actually quite nice to have Nikola around, said Edison. It's been a pleasure to bounce ideas off him, see what he thinks of the new cameras. My boys are very much in awe. I built the camera lab next to Tesla's. Black Mariah, I call it. A motion picture studio. It's fun. All in all, these years have been... well, they've been the happiest of my life. So whatever part you played in that, Mr. Cravath, I just wanted to say, you didn't do so badly. Paul stared. After a long moment of silence, he laughed. Of all the things he'd imagined that Thomas Edison might ever say to him, he'd never imagined that. He extended his hand and Edison shook it. All four men turned their attention to Niagara. Together they gazed out at the froth. The wet spray rose up from the waterfall, a mist rising up to the heavens. The effect was hypnotizing. As they stared, Paul noticed that Tesla's eyes went elsewhere, to somewhere that none of the others could see. Wonder, said Edison. Paul turned. What's that? Wonder, said Edison again. I fear it's soon out. It won't ever go out, said Westinghouse. Wonder? Asked Paul, not quite following along. Our age of invention, explained Edison. These days of handcrafted miracles. They won't last much longer. Does that ever worry any of you? Light bulbs, electricity. It seems likely that ours will be the last generation to ever gaze wide-eyed at something truly novel. That our kind will be the last to ever stare in disbelief at a man-made thing that could not possibly exist. We made wonders, boys. I only wonder how many of them are left to make.
The study of science, said Tesla. It is not ever to end.
Edison nodded. That's true, but it won't be like this. It will be more technical. Inside the magic box, not outside it. A light bulb is intuitive. An X-ray is practically alchemy. The machines are becoming so infernally complicated that barely a soul can even conceptualize how they work. And moreover, they won't need to in order to use the things. From here, we can only build incrementally. Improvements, not revolutions. No new colors, only new hues. Do you remember the first time you saw a light bulb at work?
I practically fainted, said Westinghouse. I didn't think it was possible. That was barely 15 years ago.
Exactly, said Edison. And when was the last time you saw anything that made you feel that way?
I always saw it, said Tesla.
The men turned to him.
The electrical bulbs. I have seen them always.
He tapped his fingertips twice against the side of his head.
Here.
Westinghouse and Edison both laughed.
We know, said Westinghouse. and we're grateful for it.
Edison asked, Have you met that young fellow, what's his name, Ford?
I gave him his first job, said Westinghouse. I must have given him his second, said Edison. He's probably younger than Mr. Cravath here. It's depressing. I like Henry Ford, I honestly do. But he's not... Well, he's just cut of a newer cloth, that's all. So damned professional. Everything done to perfection. His career planned out from the start. He knows exactly where he's going, what sort of company he wants to start, how to run it, what they'll work on. Can you imagine? In our day, all you had was a few stray strips of wire and, if you were really lucky, enough pennies for a stamp to mail a sketch to the patent office. Ford has a goddamned business plan. A professional inventor, said Westinghouse. A professional scientist, said Edison. Darwin never made a cent off what he did. Neither did Newton, Hooke. The whole of the Royal Society lot, they simply found things out. Invented things because they could, not because there was any money in it. We got wealthy doing what they did for fun. And now a whole generation is setting out to grow rich from their idle fiddling. And so there will be little fiddling that remains purely idle. The irony in Edison's speech made Paul smile, but he kept his amusement to himself. This newfangled marriage of business and science that would birth technology was precisely what Edison himself had created. It was his greatest invention. And, like all progeny, it was now going to leave its maker behind. Paul watched the three inventors fall into silence as they stared out at the churning falls. The current war already felt like an exotic and arcane quarrel. Like a strange dream whose plot had faded in the morning light. Their machinations would soon be forgotten. But the world it had led to, the one in which he now lived, was permanent. Who had invented the light bulb? That was the question that had started the whole story off. It was all of them. Only together could they have birthed the system that was now the bone and sinew of these United States. No one man could have done it. In order to produce such a wonder, Paul realized, the world required men like each of them. Visionaries like Tesla, craftsmen like Westinghouse, salesmen like Edison. And what of Paul? Perhaps the world needed men like him too. Mere mortals to clean up the messes of giants. Clever men to witness and record the affairs of brilliant ones. Perhaps if Tesla had invented the light bulb, and Westinghouse had too, and so had Edison. Well then, Paul had a claim to it himself. Maybe Paul was more of an inventor than he'd thought. He smiled very briefly at the notion. The men said their goodbyes. One by one, the inventors drained their glasses as they drifted back from the misty precipice. Paul was the last of them to leave. He watched as the sun began to set across the water. The river glowed the day's last rainbow of golden yellow and shimmering orange. He turned away, descending the stairwell, into the darkening shadow of a country that was just becoming America. A note from the author. As a work of historical fiction, this novel is intended as a dramatization of history, not a recording of it. Nothing you've read here should be understood as verifiable fact. However, the bulk of the events depicted in this book did happen, and every major character did exist.
Much of the dialogue comes either from the historical personages' own mouths or from the tips of their prodigious pens. Yet many of these events have been reordered, and characters appear in places they may not have. I frequently invented situations that very well could have happened but were certainly not documented. This book is a Gordian knot of verifiable truth, educated supposition, dramatic rendering, and total guesswork. What I'd like to do in this note is to help untangle it for you. Additional material, including a chronology of actual events, can be found on my website, MrGrahamMoore.com. Almost all of the events that historians generally describe as forming the current war took place between 1888 and 1896. I have compressed the narrative into only 2 years, from 1888 to 1890. As you'll see, even though most of the major scenes depicted did occur in one way or another, I fudged their chronology. What was often simultaneous in real life becomes sequential in this book. I've frequently taken multiple events or multiple historical characters and amalgamated them. This is to help the reader's tracking of the many storylines and to give narrative shape to the messily discrete events of history. Empires of Light, Edison, Tesla, Westinghouse, and the Race to Electrify the World by Jill Jones is, for my money, the most delightful nonfiction account of the current war. It contains brilliantly sketched portraits of Thomas Edison, George Westinghouse, and Nikola Tesla, as well as thoughtful insights into their rivalries and antipathies. When I first discovered that a 26-year-old attorney, only 18 months out of law school, was at the center of the current war before going on to found one of America's most preeminent law firms, I immediately wanted to learn everything I could about him. I was shocked to find that there is no proper biography of Paul Cravath. It was this absence of scholarly history that inspired me to write this book, and it was the paucity of material available that dictated it should be a novel. The basic biographical information about Paul Cravath and his family contained in the novel is true. My descriptions of Paul and his life come from the few sources we have. The Cravath firm and its predecessors, 1819 to 1948, Robert Swain, privately printed, a New Yorker profile of him from when he became chairman of the board of the Metropolitan Opera in 1932, Public Man, The New Yorker, January 2, 1932, an entry in the National Cyclopedia of American Biography, Volume 2, 1902, his and Agnes's wedding announcement, Marriage of Agnes Huntington, Chicago Tribune, November 16, 1892, the Oberlin Student Newspaper, and, of course, his court filings. My depiction of Thomas Edison is largely based on The Wizard of Menlo Park, How Thomas Alva Edison Invented the Modern World by Randall Strauss. It's a wonderful and highly engaging biography of Edison, and it supplied a lot of Edison's personality and biography in this book. Edison's voice is drawn from his letters and journals, which are kept at Rutgers University. Edison wrote in his diary most every day of his life, and through it one gets a fascinating glimpse of his inner thoughts. The majority of the Edison papers at Rutgers are online as of this writing. There is no definitive biography of George Westinghouse, but that's a book that I would very much love to read one day. All personal and biographical description of Nikola Tesla contained here is accurate. Margaret Cheney's Tesla, Man Out of Time, was an extremely helpful resource, as was Tesla's own autobiography, My Inventions, the Autobiography of Nikola Tesla. It's as singular a reading experience as you'd expect. Many historical accounts of Nikola Tesla mention his impenetrable accent and the difficulties faced by those struggling to decipher his speech. In real life, however, his grammar was impeccable, if elaborate. It was only his thick accent that made him so hard for Americans to understand. This left me with a problem. How to convey Tesla's accent on the page? I could transliterate his Serbian accent, but that seemed inelegant to read. Mr. Cravath. But as I read through Tesla's autobiography, a solution presented itself. Tesla wrote in long, winding, grammatically adventurous sentences. His English was fluent, but it was almost archaic, even for the 1880s.
Every sentence reads as if it's about to fall in on itself from the grammatical circumlocutions and unexpected word choices. What I've done here is to use his writing style as a model for his speaking style, while upending the grammar, so he's even harder to understand. This makes his sentences as confusing to read as they would be to hear. When it comes to Agnes Huntington, the historical record is shockingly blank. All information that we have about her comes from an article about her career and marriage in The Illustrated American, December 3, 1892. Her entry in The Dramatic Peerage from 1892. Her entry in Woman's Who's Who of America, 1914 to 1915. An interview she gave about her legal troubles with W.H. Foster. Agnes Huntington's story, The New York Times, December 14, 1886. Her entry in Lippincott's Magazine of Literature, Science, and Education, Volume 49, 1892. A review of her performance in Paul Jones in New York, The New York Times, September 21, 1890. The 1870 U.S. Census of Kalamazoo. Gossip reports of her engagement to Henry Jane. Town Topics, November 3, 1892. Did He Jilt Paul Jones? The Washington Post, October 30, 1892. Denied by Miss Huntington, The New York Times, October 30, 1892. From those sources, I can confidently assert the following. Agnes Huntington was born in Kalamazoo, Michigan, but never found renown, or even mention, in society, until her first appearance singing in London. She made a name for herself in Europe, accompanied always by her mother, who seemed oddly silent about their family background. As far as I can tell, even though Agnes and Fanny have the last name Huntington, they were not related to the famous Huntington family, either its California branch or its East Coast one. Agnes had some sort of murky legal squabble with the manager of the Boston Ideals. She had many gentlemen admirers of very high status on both sides of the pond. She was engaged to Henry Jane for a time, but he broke it off in 1892. She later married Paul Cravath, an up-and-coming New York lawyer who at that point in their lives would have been of considerably lower social status. Everything else about Agnes's story in this novel is imagined. The stolen dress, the borrowed name, etc. The manner in which she meets Paul, hiring him as her attorney, is also imagined, though the case for which she hires him is real. In reality, her lawyer was named Abram Dittenhofer. In compressing the timeline of events, however, I've moved this legal case from 1886 to 1888. In real life, it would have been resolved before Paul became Westinghouse's attorney. It is my belief, though I can't prove it, that the historical Agnes Huntington was hiding something about her past. Something tells me her real story is even more fantastic than the one I've created for her in these pages. Chapter 1, the opening scene of The Burning Workman, is based on two real public immolations, one on May 11, 1888, A Wireman's Recklessness, The New York Times, May 12, 1888, and another on October 11, 1889, Met Death in the Wires, The New York Times, October 12, 1889. Paul was likely not present for either of these, but as the first took place mere blocks from his office, placing him on the scene seemed reasonable enough. Chapter 7, Reginald Fessenden did work for Edison before he went to work for Westinghouse, with a stop at Purdue in between, though the timeline has been simplified here. Fessenden was not actually Edison's mole within the Westinghouse operation. The real mole was of lower status, a humble draftsman arrested in 1893. Chapters 15 through 16. Tesla did go to work for Westinghouse outside Pittsburgh in 1888 in exchange for a license on his alternating current patents. The fundamental shift in strategy on Westinghouse's side in going from a house-by-house electrical system to a network electrical system is discussed in Thomas P. Hughes's fascinating Networks of Power, Electrification in Western Society, 1880 to 1930. However, in reality, this shift was not as sudden as I've rendered it. Westinghouse had been interested in AC technology for a few years before Tesla's demonstration, which is real, though Westinghouse was not present for it. Westinghouse acquired a portfolio of AC patents to develop as early as 1886. He just hadn't gotten the technology to work yet. Chapter 21, the crisis concerning royalty structures that confronted Westinghouse and his attorneys following Tesla's sudden departure, is real, though the timeline has been compressed and we don't know whether the negotiating error was Paul's. Chapter 25, both the mysterious fire in Tesla's laboratory as well as Tesla's ensuing mental breakdown and amnesia did occur. They just took place at different times and in a different order than the sequence presented here. In 1892, Tesla's long hours of work in his lab on the concept of wireless telephones sent him into a mental breakdown. He passed out and woke with no memories of his life at all, save scattered images of his infancy. He spent months in bed, struggling to regain his memories. It was some time before he was finally able to invent again. This episode recalled other moments of mental illness in Tesla's life. According to his autobiography, he experienced frequent hallucinations, both visual and auditory. He wrote, "These hallucinations usually occurred when I found myself in a dangerous or distressing situation, or when I was greatly exhilarated. In some instances, I have seen all the air around me filled with tongues of living flame." These visions, however, gave him insight into the machines he began to design. Thomas Hughes and others have explored whether Tesla might have been diagnosed with schizophrenia were he alive today. To my mind, it seems likely that he would have been. Tesla figuratively saw the world in ways that no one else did, in part because Tesla literally saw the world in ways that no one else did. 3 years after this breakdown and recovery, on March 13, 1895, a fire engulfed Tesla's lab. Tesla was not present when this fire broke out. He discovered it the next morning, at which point he became inconsolable as to the destruction of his machines. Chapter 34, Paul's big idea that he could construct an industrial system for the law, just as Westinghouse had for manufacturing and Edison had for inventions, is very much accurate. I think it's fair to say that Paul Cravath invented the modern law firm in exactly the same way that Edison, Westinghouse, and Tesla invented the light bulb. However, Paul is generally credited with inventing his Cravath system in the early 1900s. I've moved this idea to 1888-90 so that it might fit within this narrative. Whether Paul was in fact inspired by Edison and Westinghouse when he had this idea is impossible to say. But seeing as he did implement these ideas after his experience with those two inventors, it seemed to me likely that he was. Chapter 36, Agnes's interview with the New York Times, is real, though I've combined two Times pieces, Agnes Huntington's story, December 14, 1886, and Paul Jones in New York, September 21, 1890, into one. Chapter 37, Harold Brown's character and backstory are largely accurate, and are discussed in Jill Jones's Empires of Light as well as in Tom McNichol's AC/DC, The Savage Tale of the First Standards War, Mark Essig's Edison and the Electric Chair, and Richard Moran's Executioner's Current. The timeline of Brown's campaign to promote the electric chair has been compressed. I depict the flurry of activity over the chair as happening in early 1889, but it actually happened at the end of 1887. The description of Brown's horrifying animal electrocutions is accurate. Brown's dialogue in these scenes is partially verbatim, though I've trimmed some parts and elaborated upon others for a more conversational tone. If anything, I have probably minimized the physical horrors he committed on these poor animals. In reality, he quickly progressed from dogs to horses to, seriously, an elephant. Chapters 38 to 39, someone really did break into Harold Brown's office in August 1889. After the burglary, stolen letters proving a connection between Edison and Brown were leaked to the New York Sun. Did Paul do it?
Most historians feel that someone on Westinghouse's side did. If so, it stands to reason that Paul at least knew about it and kept the secret. So while this scene is invented, Paul's moral culpability in the events thereof is certainly plausible. Chapter 41, what Paul refers to as the lie on Edison's patent application, that is, the discrepancy between the filament specified and the filament that his company would come to use, is accurate. However, I've simplified the progression of Edison's filament experiments, and whether or not this constitutes deceit rather depends on one's perspective about the nature of invention. Edison's undeniable fraud about when he'd gotten the bulb to work, on the other hand, has been depicted fairly. Edison's habit of exaggerating to the loyal press, or in this case, flat-out lying to them, was a recurring theme throughout his career. Chapter 48, the courtroom scene of Paul arguing against AC use in a New York State execution, is a dramatization of a real case. The murder is real, but I've moved it from March 1889 to May 1889. Westinghouse was in fact betrayed by Charles Coffin in the manner described, a treachery that took his team by surprise. One of Westinghouse's lawyers really did go to Buffalo to try this case in court, though it was not Paul. And Harold Brown was not present. Chapter 49, the description of the execution of William Kemmler is accurate, and comes from contemporaneous newspaper accounts, such as Far Worse Than Hanging, the New York Times, August 7, 1890. Also, while the electrocution itself is described accurately, neither Paul nor Harold Brown was in fact there to witness it. Chapters 50 to 52, the financial crisis that followed the Baring Brothers collapse is real, though I've moved it from November 1890 to September 1889. The tactics by which Paul and Westinghouse attempted to weather the crisis have been rendered accurately. That Edison and Morgan then used their considerable Wall Street muscle to drive Westinghouse further toward bankruptcy is true, though it's hard to know exactly what backroom deals were being made during the financial crisis. Chapter 55, all descriptions of Fisk University are accurate, as are descriptions of the Cravath family's involvement therein. Based on The Cravath Firm and Its Predecessors, 1819 to 1948 by Robert Swain, and Thy Loyal Children Make Their Way, Fisk University Since 1866 by Revis Mitchell, Jr. All description of the work on X-rays that Tesla conducts there is based on real work that Tesla did in 1895, though not, of course, at Fisk. The specific characters of the Fisk students are invented. Chapters 56 to 57, the scene of Alexander Graham Bell is imagined, though Bell's history and personality have been rendered as accurately as possible. All of the backstory on Bell depicted here is real, if simplified, and is based on Reluctant Genius, Alexander Graham Bell and the Passion for Invention by Charlotte Gray. In this book's final chapters, Paul Cravath hatches and implements a multifaceted plan to win the current war. This plan involves organizing a secret coup within Edison General Electric, backed by J.P. Morgan, to depose Edison as the company's head and replace him with Charles Coffin. Then Nikola Tesla is talked into signing away his royalties on Westinghouse's AC systems. The current war is ended, with Westinghouse victorious and Edison tragically excommunicated from the company he founded. All of these events occurred. However, the timeline of events has been compressed from a few years to just a few months, and Paul has been depicted as the mastermind behind the whole thing. In reality, we don't know what his role was. It is unlikely that Paul was present at the swindling of Tesla. Jones describes Westinghouse visiting Tesla alone and delivering the arguments Paul makes in this novel. Tesla seemed, in his own writing, proud of his decision to give away the royalty. He really did believe what Westinghouse told him. Chapter 72. Paul, Westinghouse, and Tesla did attend an event at the Niagara Falls power plant on July 19, 1896. However, I've combined some details of this event with a subsequent one at which only Tesla was present in January 1897.
Edison was not at either of these ceremonies. However, Tesla had taken refuge in Edison's West Orange laboratory after the fire at his lab. The two men had become friends. And then, on Tesla's way to Niagara Falls, he actually stopped by Westinghouse.